You're listening to episode 9 of the Book Thingo podcast, featuring lively discussions about romance books, culture, and literary merit. This episode, titled Books of Vibrant Social Objects, features an interview with Beth Driscoll and was recorded at GenreCon 2015 at the State Library of Queensland. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this episode was recorded and pay respect to their elders, both past and present.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookthingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. I'm super excited about this episode because it features Beth Driscoll, who is a lecturer at the University of Melbourne. She's working on a research project called Genre Worlds, Australian Popular Fiction in the 21st Century, with Lisa Fletcher, who was also on the podcast in episode 7. Beth has written papers on Nora Roberts, Harry Potter, and the Oprah Book Club. She introduced me to the concept of literary gatekeepers, and she's a great advocate for online reader reviews. I was lucky enough to sit down and chat with Beth at GenreCon last year, and I think there are a lot of interesting ideas in this discussion. Who decides which books are good and which stories are worth telling? What is the function of literary prizes? How do we assign value and prestige to books? And who has the authority to talk about genre? I should mention that towards the end of the podcast, I bring up something that Lisa Fletcher and I had talked about around academic work in genre fiction. My paraphrasing of Lisa's side of the conversation are based entirely on my own interpretation, and so I just wanted to make that clear in case I've inadvertently misconstrued anything she said. You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 9. The audio for this podcast was produced by Rudy Bremer. Welcome, Beth, to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kat.
And congratulations on the grant that you just received from the Australia Research Council.
Thank you.
I believe that the work is a collaboration between yourself, Lisa Fletcher, Kim Wilkins, and
David Carter.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your role in that research project?
So Kim is a creative writer and a lecturer in creative writing. Lisa's a literary studies scholar, and I have the publishing studies background, which is also a little similar to the work David Carter's done on print culture. And so we're going to be looking at this idea of the genre worlds of Australian popular fiction. So how do the books get created and brought out into the world? So that's a question about the writers, but it's also a question about publishers and, you know, all the different processes that are involved. So I love this idea that we can bring together all sorts of different perspectives and different questions and produce a really rich picture of books in Australia and how they get here.
And your focus is going to be on crime fiction, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the challenges for researching popular fiction is that there's so much of it, and each genre is incredibly active and diverse. And so a lot of the existing research in this area has just looked at one genre, and we really want to talk more broadly than that and compare genres and look at how they influence each other. And you and I are having this conversation at GenreCon, and that's one of the great things about this convention, looking at the way writers from different genres listen to writers from other genres and pick up tips and so on. So we're thinking, how can we manage to do that? How can we build really good accounts of each genre but also keep them in conversation with one another? And so the idea is that each of us will kind of be project lead for a genre, and I'll be the project lead for Australian crime fiction with David Carter. But then we'll make sure that Lisa, Kim, David and myself talk together all the time anyway, so we'll just make sure that as well as doing our own thing, we keep thinking about the other genres too.
The other interesting thing about this project is that it looks at the books not just with respect to the writing, but also with respect to the process of publishing the work, which I don't think has been a preoccupation of academic work, really, especially not for books published in modern time. Have you had a chance to look at that yet, or is that still just an idea germinating?
So there's plenty more work that we will be doing, but I do feel like my own work anyway has taken this sociological approach. It's like thinking about books not as just a writer in a garret with a blindfold on produces a masterpiece and that's the end of the story. Books are kind of vibrant social objects that lots of people are involved in. And, you know, for example, some of the research I've done has looked at books that were featured on Oprah's book club, and those books have an incredible social life, and I love tracking that. And and so I think that it's in some sense a continuation of that for me, and you know, the other researchers might have different ways of explaining how that works for them.
I heard you speak on a panel at the Melbourne Writers Festival around literary criticism, and it was really interesting to me how little some of the people who were there knew about platforms like Amazon and Goodreads in terms of how readers use them. So is this something that is part of your research?
I will always be interested in readers, and I love readers, and I love looking at the way they make sense of the books that they encounter. And so the online space is very important for me as a researcher, because that's a place where readers articulate and write about books and form reader communities and so on. I think that will filter through to the project in some ways. The project has to have limits to make it feasible. It's already huge, so I don't think we'll do a lot of interviews with readers for that project. But I'll keep pursuing that myself, and I think they'll inform one another.
With social media now, I mean, has it changed this landscape significantly? I mean, in the past, we would have, you know, a handful of sort of reviewers who would, first of all, choose what books were written about, and second of all, I think the perspective that they brought to literary criticism was quite limited, and I would say followed a convention maybe that readers don't really feel like, probably don't even know that they should be following.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting changes in book culture today, is that you've got an increased pool of people talking about books and with a platform to talk about books, and so you're getting different ways of understanding books and how they can affect your life being articulated. And a good example would be something like Goodreads reviews, which I've spent some time studying, and there's a real diversity of ways that people talk about books on Goodreads, but one example is that people will talk about how the book made them feel. It'll be a much more emotional kind of response to a book, and that's not something you often get in traditional criticism, which might be a bit more intellectual. But I love hearing about how readers felt when they read a book. You know, they stayed up like crying about it, or they laughed out loud or whatnot. And so I think, yeah, it's good for diversity. But at the same time, and this is, I think, something that you might have noticed at that Melbourne Writers Festival session, that there is a bit of a sense, people are worried that reader reviews online is a free-for-all, and that it's just this like massive opinions and feelings about books, and there's no way of navigating through it. And that's not the case at all. I can't believe I'm telling you this. You're such an expert in the area. But
I mean, it's self-selecting to some degree. You know, you follow people, people follow you. And I think Goodreads prioritises the reviews of the people that you're connected to anyway.
That's right. And people, and one of the ideas I'm interested in exploring is this idea of readerly capital, which is a kind of a sociological term, a kind of cultural capital. If you're a reader who regularly writes about books online, you get a kind of authority in the online space, and people who look to you for your opinions. And you know, it sorts itself into a shape, and I love watching that and seeing how that happens.
Do people fear the anarchy of social media in terms of book reactions and assigning value to books?
Yeah, I wonder if they do. And, you know, there was that one question at the Melbourne Writers Festival from someone who said she wanted to hear the opinion of someone she trusted. She wanted a trusted voice. And, you know, I guess my response to that would be to think about how we build trust, and is that the same in a world in which digital space is so important?
I wonder if there's a sense in which a platform like Goodreads, where it's readers who curate what gets to the top of the pile, in a sense that kind of challenges the established ways in which people, I guess, evaluate what an important book is, or what a meaningful book is, or even what a well-written book is. So, like, we all grow up sort of studying literature, even through high school, and the way we're taught literature, part of that is being taught how to identify what's valuable and what's not. And I feel like when you hand that power over to readers, it's a bit dangerous, it's a bit risky, because they might like, you know, stuff like 50 Shades, which people generally feel isn't really well written, but evokes a kind of emotional response. So people really love it and favorite it and tell their friends to read it. And I wonder if that's part of it. Like, who is it challenging to have readers talking about which books are important?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think that's happening with the partial migration of literary culture online is there's a bit of role confusion now. And so maybe even 50 years ago, we had a pretty clear sense of these are the critics and this is their role. They decide which books are good and which books are not good. These are the publishers. They also have a gatekeeping role. They decide which ones get out to the world, which ones don't. And that's being challenged by self-publishing, of course. And, you know, these are the authors. They decide which stories are worth telling. And everyone kind of had their role. And the reader's role was to read a book and enjoy it or not. But online, readers become reviewers, readers can become writers and self-publish their books. There are new positions appearing that didn't exist before in terms of, I guess, websites or companies that make books visible. And it's a time of flux. And so I guess that can challenge, in addition to challenging roles, that then challenges, well, what's our stable cultural hierarchy doing, and are different books going to rise to the surface or not? And I think at the same time, we've also had changes in the publishing industry in terms of a kind of, it's both a consolidation in terms of there's been lots of mergers and acquisitions, so we now only have the big five publishers where there used to be a lot more. And, you know, there are still lots of independent publishers, but there has been a consolidation across the industry and globalization too. And what it means is that I sometimes think of it as the winner-takes-all system of books. Like, one book can get a lot of attention and lots of more books can get ignored. And I guess the spacing of attention works a bit differently. And, yeah, that's another thing.
So what does that mean then when you do academic work where your foundational texts assign value in a particular way and you're looking at genre where traditionally it's always just been undervalued by definition? So then how do you approach that as an academic?
So I guess the way I approach it as an academic is I turn to sociological researchers. So Pierre Bourdieu is the theorist that I've used, and he writes a lot about taste and how taste is formed and what it says about you, what your tastes are.
So, oh, God, I don't even know what I want. I don't even want to know what it says about me.
Yeah, and one of the things that does is it makes you reflexive and think, like, I always try and put myself into my work and think about, well, why am I judging things in this particular way? Is there another way of looking at it? What has my background led me to value and not value? And so just being a bit self-aware, and I think that's really important. And then just kind of challenging the people around you to do it in the same way. I used to teach a subject called genre fictions, and students would say, this book is so badly written. And I'd just say, well, what do you mean by bad? Do you mean literally that the grammar is incorrect? And they're like, oh, no, well, you know, and so it's just thinking about the language you use when you talk about books. And
do you think it matters that the people doing academic work on genre read the genre?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I find that, like, for example, Emile Zemboun needs a particular way of reading, and if you don't know how to read it, you'll never find it good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no substitute for reading it and getting to know it and reading it as a reader would read it and then reading it a second time with a different set of questions that you bring to the text. And it's interesting, I wrote about Harry Potter in my book, and I always knew I'd want to write about Harry Potter because it's so interesting. I think it was really the first global mega seller. You know, the timing it came out was just about the time when you could have a simultaneous global launch of a book. But it took me a long time to read the books, and I had lots of opinions about the books before I read them. My supervisor, Ken Gelder, kept saying, Beth, go and read the books and then come back and talk to me. And he said it over and over, and I finally did it. And I found the books so funny and so enjoyable, and it gave me a new way of looking at them from the inside as well as from the outside. So I'd never want to let that go.
One of the things I struggle with, so I really love this increased focus on genre and particularly romance, because that's what I read.
Mm.
What I struggle with is this idea of literary merit and how it's assigned. And I don't actually have a position on it because my mind keeps changing depending on who I'm arguing with. And I like to use the Stella Prize as an example, where the Stella Prize is meant to address the discrepancy between literary prizes and the lack of representation of women in the long lists, the short lists and the winners lists. But I can't ever see the Stella awarding a romance genre book that is firmly within the genre. Like, I could see maybe you could do like a sort of a literary romantic book, but in no future world in my lifetime can I see the Stella Prize being awarded to a Mills and Boon, which is kind of, I use Mills and Boon because it's the most extreme example of a novel that's been stereotyped in romance. Is it that women need to be in this space where men's work is valued more? Or is it that value needs to be, that we need to say, no, that's not all that we value. We value all this other work as well. And until we say that we value that work, you know, pushing against a male-centric way of valuing things just isn't going to work for all women writers.
Yeah, I think prizes, I've done some research on prizes, and it's a little bit like doing research on writers. You start to see that they don't come out of nowhere, prizes. It's not like someone ascends from heaven and says, this book is the precious and valuable book. Prizes are created with terms of reference. They're judged by judges who bring their own particular idiosyncratic views of the world and their experiences to the judging process. And many of them very knowledgeable, of course, and have great experience. But they're also, you know, prizes are directed at certain outcomes. The Nobel Prize has its own history. The Booker Prize has its own history. So none of them occur in a vacuum. And I think maybe if we all paid attention to that, that might help us contextualize the function of prizes a bit more. Yeah.
But then, okay, so what that doesn't address for me is that an RWA prize just isn't going to be seen as valuable as a Man Booker Prize or even a Miles Franklin, really.
Yeah.
Or is it? Well, the other thing is, does it matter? Because if I'm a romance reader, maybe I don't care that it's not as prestigious as the Man Booker for other readers. All I care about is that for this romance fiction that I'm looking for,
this is an indicator of quality that matters to me. Yeah. I think there's a bit of that, like learning to read your prizes as a reader and to know that a book that, I know people who will avoid anything that wins a Booker Prize, for example, because they consider it too mainstream. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And actually the Booker Prize's history, if you look at it, in its early years, it didn't have the reputation it does now of being an indicator of quality. It took time for that to develop. Other people who, I heard, this is back in the old days, but a joke was made that if you win the Miles Franklin Prize, that's a guarantee you'll go out of print, right?
And I've heard this before.
And there are, I'm sure it functions completely differently these days, but there are authors for whom being in print is much more important than winning an award, because if you're in print, you have readers, and that's valuable to you. So,
you know what? The less prestigious version of that story that I've heard is that sometimes you'll get, I'll call it women's fiction, though I know that that's a term that's kind of loaded for some people, but I guess general fiction aimed at women, with the Australian Women's Weekly sticker, and there are some booksellers that absolutely hate that sticker because they can't sell those books to their readers because they're just not a good fit, even though the book itself might be a good fit for the reader. Whereas you know that sticker's there because it sells the most in maybe in shops like Target or Kmart or
BW. Discount department stores are a really big route to market for books these days.
But then what is it? What does that say about us? What does that say about book culture? That those little markers, the little market, I mean, it's just such a tiny marketing sticker has such a great impact on people's decisions on whether or not to read a book.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, what turns us towards a book and what turns us away from a book. And there's so many different factors at play. And it's interesting for me because I now read most of my books in as ebook form on Kindles, and so I'm always surprised to even see that a book has a cover and a physical substance and colour and so on. And I've read a few print books lately, and I do find it's almost in the physicality of it's almost intrusive. Like I'm used to now just going straight into the text, and that's how I do a lot of my reading. I don't know, the story I always go back to is Jonathan Franzen objecting to the Oprah's Book Club sticker on his book, and the person who responded to that in the media saying, it's funny, he doesn't object to the publisher's imprint on the spine of his book because that's a marker of prestige. His particular publisher was a very literary publisher. So every book is marked. We never have direct access to the text. Even ebooks have their own kind of ways of finding them and so on. So it's always going to be a filtered experience, and I think the most that readers can do is sort of be aware of what filters matter to them and what effect it might be having. I think, you know, we can all learn to be a bit more open in our judgments about books.
We've come to the end of another episode. Huge thanks and cocktail umbrellas to our amazing audio producer, Rudy Bremer. If you'd like more information on the books and articles mentioned in this episode, go to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and click on episode 9. Feel free to send us a tweet at BookThingo or leave us a rating on iTunes or email us at podcast@bookthingo.com.au with your feedback. You can also visit the blog to check out reviews and opinions from a bunch of Aussie readers, including Rudy and me. Make sure you check back next month when we'll be featuring some of the amazing authors and readers we were lucky enough to catch up with at the RT convention. Until then, I hope you have a fabulous month of reading.